Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and culture stories. I'm Felix Contreras. Now, just a reminder, you can, as always, subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, in a new Sherlock Holmes series, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Victorian world is set on a 21st century stage. Holmes still lives at 221B Baker Street, but now he's next door to his sandwich shop, and Dr. Watson is a blogger. Also, in a new book, NPR reference librarian extraordinaire Kim Oleski compiles the most interesting facts she's found during her tenure at NPR. And 50 Great Voices profiles Celia Cruz, who grew up in the music-rich neighborhoods of Havana and became known around the world as the Queen of Salsa. But first...
That singer whipping her hair back and forth is an internet sensation. Her video viewed millions of times in the last month. She is Hollywood royalty, the daughter of Will and Jada Pinkett Smith. Willow Smith is just 9 years old, and none other than mega producer and rapper Jay-Z has signed her to a recording contract. 9 years old. Way too young, or a great tribute to Kid Power? It's become a hot topic online, and we have asked Jay Smooth to weigh in. He hosts the hip-hop radio show Underground Railroad on Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, and he hosts the online video blog The Ill Doctrine. Welcome, Jay.
Hello, good to be here.
Let's describe what's going on in this video a bit. Willow Smith has long hair, the ends have been dipped in paint, and she is doing what she says. She's whipping her hair around and splashing the room. There's a lot of dancing.
Yeah, I mean, there's various ways you could take it. She seems to be spreading her sass and attitude throughout the classroom that she's in and making all the other kids in the classroom and the walls of the classroom change colors. And I think there are a few different things that have made it really strike a chord with people. I mean, there's that genetic tendency towards irresistible cuteness that the Smith family just seems to have. And I think having someone of that age group doing something that's not sexualized and has that sass and attitude without being sexualized so that it's age appropriate, it's reached a middle ground where parents especially are happy to have something that doesn't give them a migraine but is also appropriate for their kids. And I think it struck a chord, especially for the black community and people of color, because it seems to celebrate having hair that doesn't fit the usual Eurocentric beauty standards. And it tells kids, especially young black girls, that whatever kind of hair you have, you can be proud to whip it around.
And Willow Smith here, she's not like, you know, the 7-year-olds in hot pants who were doing the single ladies dance that got so controversial. But she doesn't look like a 9-year-old to me. She's got ear, you know, sort of piercing jewelry kind of stuff going on her mouth and on her eyelid, fake eyelashes.
It is a very stylized presentation, and the style of music she's doing, you know, it has a lot of attitude and sort of a precociousness to it. Some people are put off by just how strongly stylized and processed everything is. You know, it feels like we're turning this young girl into another interchangeable pop music product that's not that different from Rihanna or Beyonce. There are some misgivings about putting such a young girl into the same media cycle that we put all of these seemingly interchangeable pop stars into.
And here's what the producer Jay-Z says. He says about her, when you have that sort of talent, there is no such thing as too young. What do you think?
I mean, I don't feel inclined to second guess Will and Jada's judgment. I mean, they certainly seem like very together people, and certainly there's no need for Willow to be a breadwinner, so if it's not working out, you know, there's certainly a safety net and she could back out at any time.
Does this sound to you like a 9-year-old singing, or do you figure that there's some auto-tuning sleight of hand going on here?
The actual song is so heavily processed and produced that it's hard to tell whether she can sing or not, and the video is so heavily edited, you can't tell for sure how well she can dance. I think she probably is very talented, but they've put her into such a processed pop vehicle that it makes talent irrelevant, as much of today's pop commodities do.
Well, Jay Smooth, good to talk to you. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you.
Jay Smooth hosts the hip-hop radio show Underground Railroad on WBAI in New York and hosts the online video blog The Ill Doctrine. Sherlock Holmes is the most popular detective in fiction. From Arthur Conan Doyle's stories came movies and television programs, and surely the brilliant detective with his encyclopedic grasp of dust and fiber is the forerunner of today's CSIs. Now, brace yourself for a way-updated Sherlock.
Possible suicides, four of them.
There's no point sitting at home when there's finally something fun going on.
Look at you all happy. It's not decent.
Who cares about decent? The game, Mrs. Hudson, is on.
The new series is called simply Sherlock. It was created by Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss. It stars actor Benedict Cumberbatch. Mr. Cumberbatch and Mr. Moffat join us from London. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello. Hello.
Now, Mr. Moffat, I understand you were a childhood fan of Sherlock Holmes. But in your version, the character is firmly planted in the 21st century.
Yes, I was a childhood and adulthood fan of Sherlock Holmes, and this was a notion that Mark Gatiss and I had together, because much as we love Sherlock Holmes, we love Victoriana, that many of the adaptations had become about the period as opposed to be about the story, and we sort of hesitantly admitted to each other once that we rather enjoy the old Basil Rathbone movies where the stories are updated to the 1940s. It seemed to somehow make it a bit less reverent and a bit more fun.
So, what things in modern life did you think would have to be included that would be something Sherlock Holmes would use?
Well, to be honest, if you map the original stories onto the modern world, the parallels are so exact and so simple that it tells its own story. It's very unusual for anyone to keep a journal now. No one would keep a diary the way Dr. Watson used to in the old stories. And you thought, but of course, you'd do a blog. In the original stories, one of the features of Sherlock Holmes was that he would read everything. That he was born for the internet and for the chat room and for forums and all that. I think he'd love it. It would finally be the speed and the intensity of information that that demented man craves.
Now, Benedict Cumberbatch, you're absolutely running up against a huge fan base over here. For the Sherlocks of the past, we ask NPR listeners, what do you think? And we got this on our Facebook page from Monica Jenkins, who said, woe to the actor trying to overcome or outdo Jeremy Brett's interpretation.
He's a very different actor to me and a very different Sherlock Holmes. And while him and Basil Rathbone have my vote as the all-time greatest late Victorian Holmes, there is less woe to fear than the lady writes of in her warning, her oracle-like warning.
When this show was about to air in Britain, a lot of people were saying those things. It shouldn't be updated, and no one can beat Jeremy Brett, no one can beat Basil Rathbone. The truth is, it's not like our Sherlock Holmes replaces the existing Sherlock Holmes. It's another one.
And while I do agree with the lady, there's enough originality in what I give and what Stephen and Mark have written for it not to tread on the hallowed turf that is Jeremy Brett.
How did you think your way into the physical character of Sherlock Holmes?
Well, the book, as Jeremy, I'm sure if he was alive, would also say, is the template for any actor playing Holmes. And whether it's a raised eyebrow, whether it's the clasped hands under the chin in the prayer position, whether it's him sitting on his haunches, all of that is documented in the books. The books are the guideline for that. You'll have to watch, really, to do a blow-by-blow comparison. I'm not here to do that, but I would urge people, if they're interested in watching it, to watch it for all sorts of reasons, including that one.
Now, we don't have Martin Freeman here. He's the actor who plays Dr. John Watson. But the Watson Sherlock relationship is clearly going to be an interesting one. This is a moment when Watson, he's a military doctor invalided out of Afghanistan, he comes into Sherlock Holmes' world basically looking for a bed, a room.
Seen a lot of injuries then. Violent deaths.
Yes.
Bit of trouble too, I bet.
Of course, yes. Enough for a lifetime, far too much.
Want to see some more?
Oh, God, yes.
So how do you see that relationship developing? That's Dr. Watson in this series is not an idiot, as he is in the Basil Rathbone series.
No, he's not. I mean, in the original stories, he's a reasonably intelligent man. But I think the defining thing about Dr. Watson in all his incarnations is he's the first man a genius would trust. Sherlock Holmes sees to the heart of everything and everyone. So if he trusts you, you must be something special.
The glue between them is sort of illustrated there in that clip. they become very trusting partners. I think Sherlock sees a reliability and a complete trustworthiness in this honest, good man. It's a man who misses the theatre of war, the excitement, the adrenaline and the danger, and sees through Holmes's eyes and Holmes's London a new theatre of war and a new battle to take part in.
It's also true that the thing that people really love are the deductive connections that Holmes makes. Now, here's Benedict Cumberbatch doing that.
Van Coon was left-handed.
Left-handed?
Oh, I'm amazed you didn't notice. All you have to do is look around this flat. Coffee table on the left-hand side, coffee mug handle pointing to the left. Power sockets habitually use the ones on the left. Pen and paper on the left-hand side of the phone.
Yeah, it did require quite a lot of dexterity and hard work, but it's relishable stuff to do. And
it's one of the defining things about a good Sherlock Holmes versus a bad Sherlock Holmes is, can you do all that stuff without just sounding like the smuggest git in the world, quite honestly, and which you do very brilliantly. But, well, you know, it's the good Sherlock Holmes is, he's got to sound like someone who's just high on the fact that he's clever,
yeah,
as opposed to just thinking, ooh, I'm going to show off to everybody in this room, which is annoying.
No, it's somebody who can't help. He has ownership of the material in the sense that there's no thinking time at all. So as an actor, it's quite tricky because obviously you have so many details and you have no time to think what the next link is. It has to come out at a machine gun speed. Most of the deductions were very well plotted, but in this instance, we had to actually, on the day, think up of quite a few. So I came up with the idea of the mug handle being turned to the right for the left-handed person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I am not saying I am Sherlock Holmes, but I'm quite proud, quite proud to have had a hand in at least some of the logic of his deduction.
Stephen Moffat, are you thinking your way into the future with Sherlock Holmes? Are you planning more of them? And
oh, yes, we are. Yes, absolutely. We're absolutely. Well, it's been such a storm over here that, Mark and I are already thinking what we're doing next year.
Hints?
The critical words, I'd say, would be Adler, Hound, Reichenbach.
Okay, I've got that.
Mm-hmm.
Gentlemen, it's been wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Stephen Moffat, he's the co-creator of the new series, co-produced by Hartswood Films for BBC Wales and Masterpiece, and Benedict Cumberbatch, the new Sherlock. The first episode airs in this country on Sunday, October 24th.
I'm a dunce. I know a few song lyrics, a few baseball stats, and how to knot a tie. Left to my own devices, I confused Doric with Corinthian, Monet, Manet, and Matisse, Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal, Socrates and Sophocles, Crete and Sicily, Grover Cleveland and William Howard Taft. Hey, the capital of Missouri, Columbia, right? Or is it Branson? But my ignorance is carefully concealed on this program because I can punch four digits on the telephone and hear...
Library, can we help you?
That's Guy Maleski, who is the source of all human knowledge. I said that on the air once. It's all I have to know. She's NPR's longest-serving librarian. She was the inspiration for a PBS children's special. She's now written a book that harvests some of the facts that she's plucked so lovingly over the years. The book is All Facts Considered, the Essential Library of Inessential Knowledge. Guy Maleski joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scooter.
Now, watermelon, fruit, or vegetable?
Yes. It's both. Most of us would think of it as a fruit, but it can also be considered a vegetable because it's in the same family as cucumbers and gourds. And the state legislature of Oklahoma a few years ago decided that it would be their state vegetable.
But in theory, could California decide to make it a state fruit?
Oh, absolutely.
The rocket's red glare. Where'd the red glare come from?
Well, that's Congreve rockets,
which
was at that point in time, early 1800s, a new development in weaponry. Mm-hmm. And to get a better idea of what they are, if you've ever set off a bottle rocket in your backyard on 4th of July, that's a small version of a Congreve rocket.
We really can't stump you with anything, can we?
Well, not if it's in my book. Then I've already looked it up.
All right. Well, I think the question everybody wants to know, what's it like to work with a group of insufferable egos like you do, day in and day out?
I can't imagine who you're referring to.
I can't either, but objectively, you know.
Yeah. Well, I would say if you're
in the abstract, what's it like to
work NPR hosts and reporters? I'm very happy to support them because for the most part they're very appreciative of our efforts. But I wouldn't want to be your editors.
What does that mean?
I wouldn't want to have to tell you.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, I think almost the most astonishing fact and I hardly consider it inessential, that I encountered in your book is, you know, all of our latte swilling in this day and age to the contrary. Americans are actually drinking less coffee than we did in 1946, right?
According to the USDA, Americans in 2007 consume about 22.7 gallons, whereas in the 1940s it was more than twice that. And I think no doubt the difference is the popularity of carbonated beverages, soft drinks and the like, which were not so available in, earlier in the 20th century.
Yeah, we just had a couple, right?
So everybody drank coffee at every meal.
Some of us still do. I thank you to recognize. One of the last things that our friend, the late Dan Shore, wrote for publication was a blurb for your book. He said, Kimileski enshrines the humble fact in a way that's both instructive and enchanting. Any memories?
Well, I remember the first time Dan came into the library on was pretty much my very first day in the news library in 1990, and he expected to see the library manager, Rob. Rob wasn't there. He stopped short. I said, hello, can I help you? He said, no, that's okay. And he turned around and walked out. But once he realized—
I meant any warm memories.
Oh, no, it gets better.
Yeah.
Once he realized that I was going to be the only librarian available on Fridays and he needed information on Fridays, he did go ahead and ask me some questions, and yeah, I managed to answer them adequately. And so we did become very close friends. And I'm really very proud that he read my book, that there's a fact about him in my book, and that he wrote me that blurb.
Is that the Watergate fact?
That's right. He asked me to find the phrase "follow the money" in the book "All the President's Men" by Woodward and Bernstein. And because it's Dan Shore, and my policy is to go to any length to get Dan Shore the information he needed, I went through the book page by page. And that phrase does not appear there. And then in talking to Bob Woodward and to the screenwriter, William Goldman, Dan discovered that it's actually kind of made up for the movie, and it did not occur in real life. So I called that fact, he should have said it.
But people say it all the time to each other.
Well, now they do, certainly. And that's why Dan was asking. He wanted to use it in another context.
Did Van Gogh cut off his ear?
In the United States, it's okay to say Van Gogh. It's
okay.
What we're most used to, but it's nice of you to try.
Yeah. I wouldn't do it for anyone other than you, I assure you.
There are a couple of German scholars who recently looked at the police reports and such and think that perhaps his good friend, the painter Paul Gauguin, cut off his ear on the street in Arles when they were arguing over something. But apparently—
Excuse me. If he cut off his ear, he can't be that good a friend.
Well, they were having a bad day.
Yeah.
But they were friends over many, many years. But the curator of the Van Gogh Museum is skeptical. So I put it in there as just a maybe.
I think I know this, but let me double check it with you. Who was the first non-Native American to set foot in Chicago?
Well, it was actually an African man, a man from Haiti, whose name was Jean-Baptiste Pointe du Sable, and he constructed the first dwelling at a trading post at what is now known as Chicago.
Yeah, and they named a high school after him, although we say it Du Sable.
Of course.
Don't have—
In New York, we would say Du Sable. Du Sable.
I will say, while we're recording this interview, that what we treasure about you here, you just don't wait for the phone to ring. You find out stuff and bring it to our attention. I mean, so many of the stories that people wind up hearing that they actually like begin with you uncovering something.
Well, in any of the librarians, we read all the time. We're constantly looking at news sources, at websites, at all kinds of things that are happening in the world. And a particular host or reporter pops into mind and say, oh, so-and-so needs to know about this. So we're all very proactive. It's really a part of the proper job of a librarian.
So sometimes on those very rare occasions when we call up the extension of the library and there's no answer, it goes into voicemail. Am I correct in assuming that there are half a dozen of you crouching below the table saying...
Oh, no, it's Scott. You pick it up. We're happy to answer any call.
You have a wonderful last section where you talk about great endings to books, including, I think, just about my favorite, which is Frank McCourt's ending to... I like The Great Gatsby, too.
That is the line that makes it the great American novel, I think.
Yeah.
It's the closing line.
Born carelessly against the past.
So we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
And then you have Frank McCourt's ending from Angela's Ashes.
I stand on the deck with the wireless officer, looking at the lights of America twinkling. He says, "My God, that was a lovely night, Frank. Isn't this a great country altogether?" "Tis." All of these closing lines, which I thought was very clever of me to use that as the final fact in the book, all of them are ones that I'm so attached to, I can't even read them without choking up. Some of them I absolutely can't even read to myself without choking up.
Well, so. NPR's reference librarian, Kim Olesky, her new book, All Facts Considered, The Essential Library of Inessential Knowledge. Key, it's a great book. I'll say it. Tis.
Tis. Thank you so much.
And you can find out how many insects are on Earth and their names and read more of Key's favorite facts at our website, npr.org.
2 years ago, Democrats managed to energize Latino voters who helped put Barack Obama's presidential bid over the top. This time, though, potential Latino voters are hearing a very different message.
Democratic leaders must pay for their broken promises and betrayals. Don't vote this November. This is the only way to send them a clear message. You can no longer take us for granted. Don't vote.
That's an ad that came out in Nevada this past week from a small Virginia-based group that calls itself Latinos for Reform. But just a few days later, the L.A.-based band Oso Motley released a song calling on Latinos to do just the opposite.
Vota por la justicia, not for respect. Hey, hey, hey. Vota por la justicia, not for respect. Hey,
hey. This past week, I sat down with Raul Pacheco, frontman for Oso Motley, to find out more about the song.
Well, the song, I think, is specifically calling for people to stand up and to take the time to vote, to show that you respect yourself. And we just want to encourage everyone to vote. I know that there's an ad discouraging people to vote, which I think is immoral.
Yeah, we just heard a clip of that ad. When you first heard that, what was your reaction? I mean, effectively, it tells Latinos not to vote in November.
Yeah, I think it's a very roundabout way of asking people to be disengaged from the process, and I think that's really hurtful in the long run to anybody. I think that if we want a healthy society, that everyone needs to participate. And knowing that we're not going to get everything that we want every time you show up at the polls, every time you, you know, are involved in the shaping of a law. But to show up and be a part of the process means that your viewpoint does, you know, get in the mix. And I think that that's super important for people to remember.
Raul, a lot of Latinos were excited about President Obama's election, mm-hmm. and obviously the majority of them supported him. But could you understand why some Latinos would feel maybe like, not betrayed, but disappointed in what the Democrats have not been able to accomplish? There hasn't been immigration reform. Many states have toughened and tightened their laws when it comes to immigration issues. Could you understand the reluctance to go out and support them again?
I think I can always understand the reluctance of people not participating, but I think it's a misconception. I think it's based on wanting what you want right now. And the political process and the life process doesn't happen that way. If I'm learning how to play guitar, it takes me years to kind of get to a level where I can do it in front of people and make an impact. If you have an issue, it takes a long time, but you need to be constantly involved in it. And I think not only for Latinos, but for all of us, we have a tendency to, you know, I voted for this, it should happen now. It's not the way it works. What I'm telling people is that you have to go back and keep at it. And that long-term, consistent participation is something that I really think pays off.
That's Raul Pacheco of the band Oso Motley. Their new song is called Respeto. It encourages people to come out and vote on November 2nd. Raul Pacheco, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah,
here's one review of a Celia Cruz record, Play It Loud, It Will Make You Dance. Well, that's a pretty good recommendation, and it's one reason Cruz is one of the 50 great voices we're talking about this year. NPR's Noah Adams is going to get to know her better now by focusing on one particular song.
Here's the cut we'll be playing. Celia Cruz sings Kimbara.
Kimbara, kumbara, kumba, kimbamba. Kimbara, kumbara, kumba, kimbamba. Kimbara, kumbara, kumba, kimbamba. Kimbara, kumbara, kumba, kimbamba. Hey, mama.
This is from 1974. Celia Cruz was already in her 40s, and Kimbara made her famous all over again. Celia Cruz was born in 1925 in Havana and grew up in a music-filled neighborhood. She traveled for 15 years with a Cuban orchestra and did not go back home when Fidel Castro took over.
La rumba me está llamando. Bongo, dile que ya voy.
I wanted to get a better understanding of this sound, the voice of Celia Cruz on Kimbara. I knew Charles Williams could help. He sang opera for years, and now he's a vocal coach. I'd met him back in the summer at a music camp in West Virginia. So I asked Charles Williams for his evaluation of this singer. I'd kept it a surprise. He didn't know who he'd be listening to. This is Celia Cruz.
Oh, Celia Cruz from Cuba. Yes. My God. What a goddess.
Listen to Cruz sing. Her voice seems to come from a point 2 feet in front of her face.
Well, absolutely. That's her loudspeaker. You know, when I teach, I'm always saying, hey, you have to keep the tone and the bone, you know, right from the cheekbones forward. And because that's your carrying power, that's your metal, that's your bite. And then she's grounded, but it's in her body. So you got the right combination of coffee and milk, and you get this dark, light sound, this creaminess, you know, that's very exciting.
Celia Cruz, after the revolution in her country, would sing, I send to Cuba my voice from this distant beach. She settled in Fort Lee, New Jersey, married her trumpet player, Pedro Knight. They would be together for 41 years until her death. She worked with Tito Puente's band, made dozens of albums. For many fans and for many years, this song brings the smile of Celia Cruz. Kimbara is still played on the radio, makes John Fausti a happy guy, takes him back the 35 years he was the recording engineer. How does that make you feel? That's a long time ago.
It makes me feel great. I mean, I feel proud because it's truly a classic, Kimbara. Celia was so good at tongue twisters. And if you listen to the lyric of that music, it would take a tongue twister specialist to be able to execute the lyric.
The studio session was in New York City. A young John Fausti helped create a new Celia Cruz sound. Always before, she'd be recorded on a microphone in front of the whole band, just like at a nightclub. The Kimbara session was multi-track, a separate track for the congas, a separate track for the timbales, one for the trumpets, the piano. And that mix is what Cruz would hear in her headphones as she sang. She'd be surrounded by driving percussion and the splash of brass.
She didn't have to get it right the first time, but she had a chance in the overdub of the vocal to redo a part if she wasn't totally satisfied with it without having the band have to play it over again.
I actually got a chance to see her live at SOB's here in New York, which is a pretty small club.
This is Carmen Rivera, a New York-based playwright.
She performed in And it was astounding. She started performing from the basement, and she in the dark, the lights went down. She started performing, and this booming contralto voice that she had came, you know, resonated through the whole place, and it made the place feel like Madison Square Garden.
Carmen Rivera and her husband Candido Torrado wrote the play Celia: The Life and Music of Celia Cruz. It ran off Broadway, played in Miami, and recently in Chicago.
She lived such a sound life. A lot of people didn't think there was a story there.
Torrado and Rivera did see tragedy in the life of a singer in exile who couldn't go home for her mother's funeral. In preparation for their writing, they watched a lot of video footage of Celia Cruz, especially television shows. And while viewing a Telemundo tribute filmed just before Cruz passed away, the playwrights found the center of their story.
When she came out for her bow, she looked lovely. She was all in silver with a silver wig, and she can rock a silver wig, looking elegant and beautiful. And Pedro Knight, her husband, is watching her, and he's crying.
And there's so much love in his eyes and so much pain because she was already very ill. And we said, that's the story.
Those eyes.
Those eyes is the story.
La rumba me está llamando. Bongo, dile que ya voy. Que se espere un momentico mientras canto un guaguanco. Dile que no es un desprecio, pues vive en mi corazón. Mi vida es tan solo eso, rumba buena y guaguanco.
Celia Cruz was 77 when she died. 200,000 people in Miami came to say goodbye to the Queen of Salsa. Noah Adams, NPR News.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Felix Contreras. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia.